you can't really start a discussion about Canada without recognizing the fact that I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for the Indigenous peoples of Canada ensuring that my ancestors survived. And this includes, so any conversation about Canada, we have to mention the Algonquin people, the Mi'kmaq, the Cree, the Mohawks, the Maliseet, the Blackfoot, the Ojibwe, the Chippewa, the Sequatmec, the Coast Salish territories, the Haida, the Innu, the Inuit, and many more I haven't named. These were distinct nations with their own characteristics before first contact, who had their own constitution, in fact, called the Great Peace. There are less Indigenous people in Canada today than there was at first contact. So that's the colonial history of Canada, a colonization that continues to this day, both within its borders and outside its borders. So why do I mention this? Because we need to be reminded in North America of that colonial past, because it's not over. And a lot of the features of the current structures of our governments and our societies are rooted in that colonialism and are extending it in the name of profit today. And it reminds us also, remembering that colonial past, that there is the possibility of a different relationship to each other and a different relationship to production, a different relationship to human beings. So I'd like to thank Satim, and I would like to thank the organizers and the interpreters and all the workers that have put their effort into this this occasion happening. So to talk about NAFTA, you have to talk about it in the context of neoliberalism, because it can't be separate from it. It's one piece in a puzzle, and a continuing puzzle involving five main components, which include commodification, deregulation, privatization, deunionization. And I think I'm missing one, but maybe somebody can fill it in for me later when we have a discussion. So as NAFTA was a stepping stone to a deeper ongoing neoliberal process, you know, it tells me, you know, I really, you know, I respect, for example, religion. I respect all religions and the right of people to practice religions. But I don't like it, a connection between religion and state. And the current economic model is a religion. It's a blind religion, a blind faith that just repeats the same mantra over and over while billions of people on this planet suffer the consequences. So I think we have to frame the current economic model as almost like a kind of a cult thinking. And a thing that eventually we hope will be swept into, as a sort of dark past in our history. It's an economic religion. And with a refusal to consider the possible, only the banal and the commodification of all things. And when I say all things, I mean all things. Our homes, our communities, our streets, our air, our water, our bodies. All of it. All of it's on the table under this system. So I'm going to speak a little bit about NAFTA specifically. I'm going to talk a little bit about some social indicators, some economic indicators, some labor, the question of democratic control of your own community and society, and I'm going to talk about migrants. There are many more things to talk about. For example, you know, cuts to social programs, which were directly, you know, went after marginalized communities, or communities seeking more quality in the society. For example, all funding was cut to our National Action Committee on the Status of Women. This is a group that existed for many years to push the issue of women's equality in our society. This was wiped out following NAFTA. There's no need, I guess, to hear from women in the new economic order. Now, you may or may not know that before NAFTA was signed in 1994, there was also a Canada-US trade agreement signed in the late 80s. It certainly is revealing to know, as Kawaljeet Singh has pointed out, that in 1986, for example, $188 billion in financial markets traded in New York, London, and Tokyo every day. That's $188 billion in 1986. By 1995, the first year of NAFTA, it's $1.2 trillion. So we see a realignment of the state into the transnational class, clearly. And you know, and the financial speculation that goes along with that. So the capitalists say, and we heard it last night, in fact, from the trade ambassador, the Swiss trade ambassador, that it's good for us. That it's all about jobs and consuming. Well, it certainly wasn't good for Canadians. We were promised jobs, jobs, jobs. In fact, that was a mantra, that was a slogan that was used by the government at the time. I was working in the post office in those days during the free trade election, and where 60% of Canadians, almost just under 60%, voted against free trade. But it wasn't a referendum. They just voted for the parties that opposed it. But under our system, which really isn't a democratic one, a party can get 35% of the vote and rule the country with 100% majority, and that's essentially what happened. So we got stuck with free trade. Now, when I worked in the post office, people had this illusion, this belief, not everyone, but a number of my coworkers, that free trade would mean lots of jobs, it would mean a higher standard of living, and it would play into that consumer mindset, because people close to the U.S. border always used to drive across the border to pick up stuff, you know, electronics and TVs and stuff, because it was cheaper. So people had this consumerist belief, which was fed by full-page advertising by transnational corporations in our newspapers and ads and so on, saying that, you know, you would have lots of jobs, but you'd be able to buy products at American prices with a Canadian wage. So people bought this nonsense, and they really promoted it. So overnight in Canada, we lost 250,000 manufacturing jobs. So these were the jobs that kind of disappeared almost overnight after the deal was signed. Things that were produced locally and were good for the environment and good for communities and good for the local community vanished. And, of course, it wasn't good for Mexicans either, as Alfredo has pointed out, and I think it's worth noting that the average household income in Mexico by 2004 was 15% lower than it was in 1994. But in the first 1 year of the implementation of NAFTA in Mexico, millionaires increased by 50%. So how did it come into being? And I'm not going to run through the whole election and everything, but it can't be spoken about NAFTA without mentioning the social clauses, because we see NAFTA is kind of a model for including this notion of, you know, that we can make this a kinder, gentler capitalism. We really care about, you know, human rights. And so a labor clause was attached, and which split the labor unions. Some unions were just completely opposed to NAFTA. Others thought, oh, yeah, well, this labor clause would be great. In fact, Canada has no business to talk about anyone about human rights. We have a dark history and an ongoing dark history that for some reason, through our marketing and our smiling faces and our friendliness and our maple syrup, we're able to sort of obscure the real reality that goes on in Canada. For example, today, within the last 10 years, 1,000 Indigenous women have disappeared in Canada without a trace. Treaties are signed with Aboriginal people that aren't honored. The law only applies to business. It doesn't apply to the people. So, for example, you know, very costly procedures for First Nations to go into the courts, and they win. They win in the Supreme Court. There are treaties signed that aren't honored, and they win in the courts, and still nothing happens. So there's a bit of a theater in Canada, and a really dark theater. And at its darkest, of course, Indigenous people were kidnapped. Children were kidnapped from their parents by the thousands for about 100 years and forced into residential school systems where they never saw their parents again. They were beaten for using their language. They were abused. In some cases in the north, the police went into communities and shot. The people were nomadic in the north and shot their sled dogs and forced them to stay in one place. So that's the real history of Canada. And when we talk about rights, I don't think that's exactly the right term. A strong Mohawk warrior woman told me that human dignity and human freedom aren't something to be found in courts. They naturally exist on this earth, and we have to claim it, that we don't need courts for permission to be human. And I think that's worth thinking about with these trade agreements. We've never seen a successful case of a labor standards issue brought before NAFTA that's been successful for workers. And in fact, countries don't want all three NAFTA countries abuse labor rights, and they may have wonderful language on paper, but the enforcement in all three countries is another matter altogether. For example, Canada has denied the right to collective bargaining and the right to strike more than any other country on earth since 1980. It's pretty much routine now that you'll be legislated back to work as soon as you're in a strike position or within a couple of days of going on strike or even before you're in the position to strike. So I'm not sure what labor rights Canada would be promoting in Mexico, but I would warn you in Mexico to be very cautious about any sort of talk about labor rights coming from the Canadian government or Canadian society. Now, it is interesting to note that there's an extension of NAFTA in a way. It was the first salvo, and another thing that reveals the sort of sinister nation of Canada's role in our hemisphere. And it's interesting also to note that the Swiss and the Canadians were the first to sign a deal with Colombia. So, you know, two countries that have this sort of image, right, are the first two to sign with Colombia. This was... we see the rise of Canadian mines now, right? In Mexico, there's a demonstration actually today or yesterday in Mexico about what Canadian mines are doing. Did you know that most mining companies in the world are located in Canada? In the entire planet, most of them are located in Canada. Majority, I think it's around 60, 70%. Why? Why would they register in Canada? Well, I'll tell you why. They can register in Canada because there are no scruples, there are no restrictions. So, you know, Canada's the place to be if you want to have a mining company that will hire death squads to kill people, that will force people off their lands, that will destroy the environment and face no accountability. At least in the U.S., you can be sued for activities you're doing in a third country, but not in Canada. So we have all these postal box numbers, like mining companies with like no people, just a box number in Vancouver or Toronto, a mailbox. There's no human being you can find. There's no office. So it's a very interesting process of trade that Canada is involved in. Now, Canada also, by the way, is the most secretive of the OECD countries. So it's harder to get information on our government than the 28 or 29 richest countries on the planet. We see also after free trade, and this is before 9/11, we see the rise in private security. We see the beginning a fetish with private prisons. We see all these get tough on crime laws, even though our crime rate has been dropping steadily for over 30 years. There are more people in prison. So there, people warned that there would be this harmonization with the United States, that in fact, instead of standards rising for people, we would start lowering standards to a lower common denominator. And this is exactly what has happened. We see, of course, now we see Islamophobia. We also see today Canadian citizens being sent off to third countries to be tortured. Very, very sad. And this is part of the Canadian reality that maybe you don't hear about so much. Now, we begin to see an immense wealth, transfer of wealth in Canada. As a popular educator, you'd mentioned some of the work I do, and you need a football field to do this exercise. So we can line people up and say, sort of 20% of the population, each 20%, line five people up and say, this is what this 20%, their average wealth or wage was in 1994. And then you can jump ahead a few years, right, and say, for every $1,000 in growth, take a step forward. But for every loss $1,000, take a step backward. You need to do this exercise on a football field because the top 20%, you know, are way down the street. They're probably down at the lake or something. They have to take so many steps. But the bottom 20% actually go backwards, right? And you see this continue. If you just move ahead a few more years, you see it even more and more and more. And it's a very visual way to represent this this growing gap of wealth. In fact, the richest 10% before NAFTA earned 82 times of the average population. And in between 1990 and 2005, workers' wages grew 8% in Canada. Top income earners grew 64%. And income inequality increased for the first time since the 1920s. So this was the legacy of NAFTA. In 1995, the top 50 CEOs made 85 times the pay of the average worker. By 2010, it's 255 times. Now, you got to be pretty damn productive to deserve that kind of an increase, right? But that productivity isn't measured in work. It's measured in what you're prepared to do to other human beings and their livelihoods. That's where the reward is. That's where the bonus is. And so in a pathological way, I suppose, not wanting to be too, you know, psych-oriented or something, but in a very pathological way, it appears as though some people will do almost anything to sell out their other human beings in order to make a profit. And this isn't an inherent natural thing. This is a learned thing. This is a thing that trade treaties create, these opportunities for those openings in order to exploit other human beings. We see the largest social spending cuts in Canadian history. And I really love this term, you know, free trade. I mean, everything's upside down, right? I mean, the U.S. is the land of the free, right? And it has, like, the largest prison population on the planet, right? You're more likely to go to jail in the United States than you are in every other country on Earth. But it's the land of the free. And I would say with free trade, there's nothing free about free trade. Free trade for whom? It's not free for you or I. It's free for someone, but not us. And that's pretty clear. We see incredible, massive student debt rise. I mean, you know, Canada's always had a system where, except for Quebec, where you have to pay for your own education. But it is somewhat reasonable, you know, sort of middle-income families could afford to go to university. Now it's not uncommon for people come out of university and owe $80,000 in debt before they've even worked their first job. Across the street from my office, there's a coffee shop where people with master's degrees are working in the coffee shop because they can't find work. But they have this massive debt. Before they've even started in life, they have this massive debt. And we see the privatization of the university that's dependent on corporate funding. Recently had a case in Ottawa where the funding came from millionaires who actually said, but we want to control the curriculum and we want to control who is hired. And the university accepted this. This is not education. This is brainwashing, right? This is corporate, a kind of corporate fascism. Again, back to that sort of corporate religion of the markets, that the markets prevail above all and the markets will provide for everyone. Which, of course, obviously just isn't the case, and I think we should stop repeating that mantra and challenging it wherever it's said. Canada's become also a nation that's been said now we're drawers of water and hewers of wood. This is sort of our colonial legacy, where we didn't really produce anything. We just, you know, we exported products to Europe and other countries and furs and so on. And we're going back to those times, but we're repeating the past, that the indigenous lands that remain are the lands that are getting encroached on now, in spite of the treaties that we've signed with those nations. Here's a good one, too. So we used to have something called unemployment insurance. They had massive cuts after the signing of NAFTA. And we went from 83% of unemployed workers eligible for unemployment insurance, meaning if you get laid off, you know, you have some income for a while, to 42%. So it gets cut in half. And they changed the name. It's now called not called unemployment insurance. It's called employment insurance. So, you know, it's just a crazy, crazy world. Profits increase during this period, but the work between, you know, after the free trade is signed, the GDP per capita grew, but personal income growth fell to 0.63 a year from an average of between 3 and 4% a year. Now, also the myth of free trade, you know, if we examine it a little further, we reveal, and this, you know, the again, the trade ambassador spoke about this last night, you know, about the jobs, bringing good jobs, transnationals, you know, they pay better than anybody else. But they have actually lower workforces. They don't employ all that many people, and 80% of transnationals control their investment, research, and tech out of home offices in Germany, the United States, and Japan. We're now seeing, you know, Canada is in really desperate need for childcare spaces. And we did have the bones of a national childcare program by a previous government that was sort of ready to go, and then there was an election called, and they lost. And so now what we're seeing is transnational for-profit childcare spaces being created. And you can bet in those childcare spaces, indoctrination is a big part of it. So, you know, McDonald's and fast food and all that sort of stuff that goes with this current plastic society is part of that thing, giving kids just a horrible head start on life and again, a kind of economic brainwashing. Of course, you may, people have talked a little bit about the investor state rules. You know, the fact that corporations can sue our government for policies made at home, domestic policies that benefit the local population. This is just crazy. We can't sue those companies, but those companies can sue our governments. So there's almost an untouchable status. So I guess, you know, we think about this competition, and again, the trade ambassador said it last night, you know, that this is about competition. I don't think that when a baby comes out of the womb, it says, I want to compete. In fact, I can tell you from being an ex-hockey player that there's not very many winners and there's a whole lot of losers. And if you base a society based on competition, that means that somebody's going to lose. And maybe, just maybe, you know, as a baby can't live without cooperation and nurturing, maybe that we could survive better as human beings if we changed our sort of order of thinking and think about cooperation rather than competition, because competition does create losers. Are we better off today? No, we're not better off today in Canada. All indicators point that out. I wish I had more time to talk about it, but I'm running out of time here. I do think, though, that a couple of things I'd like to wrap up with is one is around the concept of green, because this is another one we've heard about, you know, environmental clauses and so on, and this has played out recently in Uganda, where, you know, Canadian corporation planted trees. It was really green. They were planting trees in Africa. Well, what they don't tell you is they used it as a carbon offset for the oil sands. The trees were planted on the land of the locals who've been living off that land for, you know, thousands of years, and they planted a monocrop, palm trees, to export the palm oil to Europe. So that was the greening of Uganda. But we do have tactical victories. I'm sorry, my glasses are falling apart. I'm not doing this for a prop, like to say, like, you know, everything is junk under neoliberalism and planned to fall apart. It actually happened. This is my fourth set of these same glasses that keep falling apart. But we do have victories. And I think we need to celebrate those victories, because it's really easy to be a victim. It's really easy to blame them. It's really easy to say, they're doing this to us. And they are, but it won't change anything. So are we so materialist that we can't touch our feelings, right? When I work with postal workers and you talk about hope and courage, people can't find that. They can't actually express a feeling in a lot of cases. They express thoughts as feelings. But if you keep at it over a few days, it's amazing. It's amazing the place human beings can move to when we also exercise all that we are, and not just, you know, sort of what's up here, but that emotional struggle is a big part of how we're going to take this stuff on. So I would say strategically, those of us in the unions have to question our relationship with our employers. We have to question the relationship of endless production and endless profit and endless consumption. And now more than ever, when we're actually getting even less of the pie. So I think patriarchy and economics leave no room for emotion, but hope and courage do. And so to change our world, I think it's a question of values, changing our relationship to time. So time works for human beings, and we're not working for it. And I'll just close by saying I would invite us to consider, and I'm not saying this in any trite or romantic or, you know, fake kind of way. I think this is really powerful knowledge that comes from the first people of the lands that we've settled on in North America. And that's that everything you do must be thought in terms of how it will affect seven generations from today. Now, to me, that sounds a lot better than a quarterly profit on the stock market, right? And that how we treat the old and the young on the earth is the measure of success and wealth. And so I do believe that our survival in North America and likely around the world will require a new relationship with land and with people, with work and understanding, and it will require creativity and perseverance. But I think if we listen really closely and listen to our hearts, we can hear seven generations calling on us right now and cheering us on. So in Grassy Narrows, in Northern Ontario, Indigenous women have blockaded logging for 10 years. They've maintained a 10-year logging blockade. And I think we should hear them too, and the Mohawk warrior women who tell us that real victories are won on the land and not in the courts.